The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Doug Benton was a welder living in Colbert, Georgia. Considered a friendly and helpful neighbor, he was known for raising and selling exotic birds from his house, lifting weights, and riding a Harley. When Doug met police deputy Tracy Fortson, the two had an immediate attraction. They began to spend most of their time together. But Doug disappeared on June 4th, 2000. Tracy cooperated with the police. She was the last person known to have seen him. She admitted that they had an argument that day and said that they had broken up. Join us at the quiet end for A Concrete Grave, The Murder of Doug Benton. When Doug's body was found, his manner of death and the disposal of his body didn't appear to be the work of an ex-girlfriend. The relationship between Doug and Tracy was volatile, but Doug also had a bit of a past. When the investigation began, evidence began to pile up, and a lot of it pointed to Tracy as Doug's killer. But Tracy had information to share about her position at the police force and a possible plot to frame her. So this is an interesting story. What have we got for a beer?
We have a nice Georgia beer called Eschaton, brewed by Wild Heaven Beer in Decatur. I remember having this. We went to a really nice pub, the Brick House or something.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one of their beers.
I remember that, yeah.
That was one of the fun days.
That's where they had the vegan BLT?
Yep.
Yeah, yum.
So this is a quad. It's 10.5% alcohol by volume, so it's another sipper type beer. It's a dark brown color with a sticky tan head. Nice aroma, some fruit, and toasted malt. And then it's got a taste of plums and raisins and some caramel or toffee. Wonderful beer. And this is another one that's kind of chewy when you're drinking it.
Okay.
Almost like you're having a meal.
Well, you know, with autumn coming up here, I'm starting to really kind of gravitate towards this type of beer.
It's a perfect beer for autumn.
I'm looking forward to it, so why don't you open it up?
Okay.
All right. This is smelling great. Can't wait to taste it. Let's go down to the quiet end, and we can have our discussion and drink this delicious beer, which is great for a cool fall day.
Yes, it is. Let's have some. So let's get into the story. Doug Benton was last seen by his neighbors on June 4th of 2000. His girlfriend, Tracy Fortson, had been seen at his house that same day. Now, she and Doug had been having trouble in their relationship, and it ended with a serious argument that weekend. That they broke up, right?
Yes. Doug had called her and left a message telling her that he really didn't want to see her ever again. So this seemed like it might have been their final breakup. You know, they had one of those relationships where breakups happened, but this one seemed like it might have been for real.
You know, break up, reconcile.
Exactly.
On June 17th, so almost 2 weeks go by, Doug's neighbors got concerned about his well-being. Several of his exotic birds had died due to lack of food and water. So the police were called to do a welfare check. They couldn't find him. and they treated his disappearance as a missing person case. Real search for Doug began when Doug's neighbor Larry Bridges met Sheriff Tom Lutz outside of his home. Hot and humid Saturday morning, typical for a June day in the tiny town of Colbert, Georgia. Larry was the one that had reported he and his girlfriend had found several dead birds. But they weren't the wild birds he was talking about. These birds that he was referring to were the colorful and exotic birds that Doug raised and sold. They're not native to Georgia. They're from far, far away.
Yeah, cockatiels, parrots, exotic birds.
Exotic birds. So the dead birds were disturbing, Larry explained to the sheriff, but he's more concerned that his neighbor, Doug, hadn't been seen in 2 weeks, or just about 2 weeks.
Exactly. So Larry explained to Sheriff Lutz that the exotic birds belonged to Doug and that Doug was known to take really excellent care of them. John Sharp Road, where Larry lived across the street from Doug, was pretty remote. John Sharp Road met up with Tom Sharp Road, which was bigger, at a fork, and then John Sharp stopped at a dead end. So everyone on that street was on a first-name basis with each other. Larry Bridges and Doug Benton, the 38-year-old missing neighbor, had been really good friends. Larry was worried because he knew Doug wouldn't leave his birds to starve. So Sheriff Lutz knocked on Doug's front door, and there was no answer. After checking all of the doors, which were locked, he tried to peer into the windows, but there was no sign of anyone inside. Then Larry pointed out the dead birds, in cages on the front porch and inside of Doug's garage. Doug really loved his birds, Larry told the sheriff. He took pride in taking good care of them and wouldn't leave them without making arrangements for their care. So his absence was very strange, and Larry was really getting worried. When asked about the last time he'd seen Doug, Larry said that it was about 2 weeks ago on June 4th. He added that Doug had fought with his girlfriend Tracy and then drove away on his Harley just before 10 a.m. There was no missing the loud exhaust of his bike. Then, at about 5 p.m. that same day, he heard Doug return. Larry added that he had seen Doug's girlfriend, Tracy Fortson, at around 3 p.m. that day, and she was looking for Doug, he assumed. He never saw Tracy, but he did notice her truck parked in the driveway. Tracy Fortson's truck was difficult to miss and very easy to identify. This was a 1998 Ford F-150 with an extended cab and tinted windows. It had a black grille cover on the front and dark black step bars running along the bottom. The license plate was personalized as well, reading 2 Tough 2. And this was a reference to the Ford truck ads, built Ford Tough. Apparently 1 Tough 1 was already taken when she applied for her license, so she settled on 2 Tough 2.
Now, Tracy was not a passive woman.
Oh, hell no.
She'd had a tough upbringing with a father who abused her mother quite a bit.
Terribly.
When she was 12, Tracy witnessed her parents fighting over a handgun. And as she made her way to the door of their bedroom, Tracy watched as her father pushed her mother onto the bed, grabbed the gun from her, and hit her in the mouth with a fist. Now, Tracy was afraid, but she felt like she had to do something to protect her mother. So she snuck up behind her father with a flashlight in her hand, and then she swung it at her father's head as hard as she could. Fortunately, seeing his daughter trying to protect her mother shook her father from his rage, and the fight stopped. Boy, that's very fortunate. He could have killed 2 people.
Oh, it's super scary, the behavior, and you have to think it affected her in some ways, because she was a tough lady. Pretty fucking scary, really, when you read about the things that she had done. So, not a meek woman at all. Tracy's mother actually took Tracy to stay with her grandmother back when she was 12, but then her mother returned to her violent husband. According to Tracy, her mother was too afraid to leave her father, and she always told Tracy, "Things will be worse for me if I don't go home, honey. Please understand." And she may have been right, sadly.
Yeah, quite probably was.
Yeah. So as the relationship between her parents fell apart, Tracy began to spend more time away from home, which is understandable, and she devoted herself to her outside activities. She had friends who had horses and motorbikes, and they would ride all over the county, just having a great time. Now, Tracy spoke to author M. William Phelps in an interview for his book Targeted, and she said she got through school as if she didn't have any parents. No one ever came to any of her school events, and no one came to her parent-teacher conferences either. They never knew that their daughter was in the student council, and neither of them ever helped her with her homework. The fights between her parents got progressively worse throughout Tracy's teenage years, and then she began making plans to leave home as soon as possible. She dreamed of going to college and becoming a veterinarian, but said that the dream died when her parents said they couldn't afford to send her to college. So that's when she began to consider joining the service. But by the time she graduated high school, her mother did file for divorce from her father. And at first, her father refused to leave the home, but the police did get involved and he did finally move out. But growing up in such an environment, Tracy had learned to speak her mind and look out for herself. She was considered to be a really tough woman who wasn't afraid of anyone. And she would become the first female sheriff of the county, working in a male-dominated world, which seemed to suit her just fine.
Yeah, well, I think that goes along with her personality.
Absolutely.
She's a woman, but tougher than all the guys.
Well, I don't know if tougher then, but she could certainly hold her own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was the leader.
Yes. A strong woman, but unfortunately, I think the violence had a really negative effect on her personality as well.
Yeah. So Doug and Tracy hadn't been getting along in the time leading up to his disappearance, at least according to his neighbor Larry. They fought often, and they fought loudly. As time went by, still with no sign of Doug, Larry didn't think much of it for a week or so. Doug worked welding jobs on construction sites, and with jobs becoming hard to find, Doug sometimes traveled for a job. He'd been known to leave town, or even the state, for work. So Larry gave a general description of Doug to Sheriff Lutz. Doug was 5'9" and weighed about 250. Wasn't tall, but he was stocky and muscular. And he loved lifting weights, and Doug and Tracy often worked out together in his home gym. So it's 5'9 and 250. That's a lot of weight for that height.
It is. He was very stocky, for sure.
If he worked out, maybe even with the help of some steroids, he wasn't overweight.
He did have a bit of a gut. But he was very muscular, and he was more of a power lifter, which I think they tend to be heavy.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. So I think he was probably pretty fit, but he was stocky for sure.
Yeah.
He didn't look like slim and athletic at all.
No, I bet he didn't.
But Larry shared with Sheriff Lutz that he'd already canvassed the neighborhood, asking if anyone had seen Doug lately. And no one had seen him since the weekend of June 4th. After he hadn't heard from Doug for over a week, Larry had started paging him, but Doug didn't answer any of Larry's pages, which was really unlike him.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Larry said he and his girlfriend decided to take a walk over to Doug's and have a look around. And as soon as they got across the street and Larry saw that several of Doug's birds had died inside their cages, he decided he needed to call the police.
A good decision.
So Larry agreed that he would take care of the few remaining live birds until Doug was found. Sheriff Lutz didn't tell Larry Bridges right then, but he was going to call and get someone from the sheriff's department to do a wellness check on the inside of Doug's house, because at this point they did have probable cause to enter without a warrant. So after Sheriff Lutz returned to the Madison County Sheriff's Department, he called the Oglethorpe County Sheriff's Department, where Larry had told him that Tracy worked as a deputy. So he hoped that she might know where Doug had gone to, and if not, she should have been able to provide a list of names to contact when they looked for him.
Yeah, but the deputy who answered Sheriff Lutz's call told him that Tracy no longer worked there. He offered to reach out to her and tell her to give Lutz a call. Lutz thanked him, ended the call. He's thinking that Doug had probably run off somewhere with his girlfriend. Doug had kids who visited him from time to time, but he lived alone. So he didn't answer to anyone, and he could come and go as he pleased. But as Lutz thought over everything Larry Bridges had told him, something just didn't seem right. And those dead birds were the clincher.
Sure, you don't do that.
Right.
There's something wrong if he's not there to take care of them.
Yeah, I mean, why would he leave them behind to die?
He wouldn't.
And even if he wasn't attached to them, they still were worth money to him.
Yeah, so if he didn't love them, I don't know if he was an animal lover or not, they still were worth over $30,000, Larry figured, which is a lot of money.
A lot of money.
Yeah.
Yep.
So let's go over the relationship of Tracy and Doug a little bit. It's an interesting one. They first met in 1997, and Tracy was working in a tanning salon next to the gym where Doug worked out regularly. Then he began to stop by to tan after his workouts. She ended up giving him her number, but then canceled. Then, nearly 2 years later, she saw Doug while she was having dinner in a restaurant with her father. This time, she found Doug very attractive. I guess he had cut off his mullet and lost some weight, and he looked more clean-cut and well-dressed.
Well, I'll bet just cutting off the mullet would do wonders for his appearance.
That will do wonders for anybody. If you have a mullet, cut it off, and you'll be 10 times more attractive instantly.
It's a public service announcement from yeah, Dick and Jill.
Absolutely. So before leaving, she walked over to Doug's table at the restaurant, and he did seem to recognize her, and he was smiling at her. So they chatted for a moment. He said it was good to see her, and she left. When she left the restaurant, she drove by herself over to a pub and hung out for a while with some people she knew. So she's having a drink, talking with friends, and about a half an hour into this, she felt her pager vibrating in her pocket. She didn't recognize Doug's phone number, but he'd gone home that afternoon, searched for the phone number from 2 years earlier, and incredibly, he found it and called her pager. He left a message saying, "Give me a call when you get home." So after that, the two began dating right away, and soon they were inseparable. As they got to know each other, Doug shared information about his past. And according to Tracy, he'd had a drug and alcohol problem, but he was clean then. Also, according to Tracy, Doug had also struggled with anger issues. He did use some steroids, which caused him to have episodes of roid rage. So Tracy said Doug had been through some tough times, and he'd also worked as an enforcer for a local drug dealer. He'd also worked as a bouncer at some local strip bars. According to Tracy, Doug went to these jobs hoping for a fight because he enjoyed inflicting pain on his adversaries. He was making up for all those times he'd been bullied as a boy, she said. And Tracy said that Doug had been a confidential informant for the Madison County Sheriff's Department. We have not been able to confirm that.
Their relationship continued, and they did spend a fair amount of time lifting weights together. Whenever they weren't working, they were together. Tracy, at that time, was working 12-hour shifts at the Sheriff's Department. And when she got out of work, Doug would take Tracy and her daughter, Elise, out to dinner. It seemed to Tracy that Doug's past was behind him. She and Doug both wanted a predictable and quiet life together. And then they also began to ride bikes together, because Doug bought an upgrade and gave Tracy his used Harley. At least at this point, for Tracy, this was the life she'd always wanted. But, according to Doug's neighbors and friends, Tracy was a very controlling woman. She seemed jealous whenever he paid attention to anyone other than her, and she could be pretty loud and intimidating.
So in April of 2000, and that's about 2 months before Doug disappeared, Tracy applied for unemployment. She'd claimed that she'd been sexually harassed while working at the Oglethorpe County Sheriff's Department. Talk around the office had been directed at her, she said, with male deputies using inappropriate and sexually offensive language. According to Tracy, she'd been made to feel uncomfortable by the rough language used by the deputies and by some inappropriate joking in the office. Her boss, Ray Sanders, denied the charges and appealed her unemployment claim. She filed a sexual harassment and discrimination case against Sheriff Ray Sanders and the Oglethorpe County Sheriff's Department. She went to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Atlanta, Georgia, too, where she filed that claim. And she hired an attorney to represent her. Tracy would later claim to have audio tapes of the sheriff making lewd sexual comments to her on the job. But the tapes have never been released. So we don't even know if they exist, in other words. She said that it was Doug who called the newspaper and made the issue public. And according to Doug's mother, there had been a history between Doug and Ray Sanders. But she didn't know what it was about or if the sheriff would be out to get Doug necessarily. But whether or not there was ever an issue between Doug and the sheriff, Tracy and Ray Sanders had a board hearing at the Labor Department that June 12th, a week after Doug went missing. Tracy's claim for compensation for sexual harassment was discussed, but the issue was not resolved. It was decided that it would take at least one more hearing before a judgment could be made. Sometime after being contacted by the Oglethorpe County deputy on June 18th, Tracy called Sheriff Lutz. Lutz never noted the date or time in his report of this call, but according to Lutz's version of that phone call, it was friendly and just pretty matter of fact. "We're looking for Doug Benton," he said. "His neighbors have reported him missing, and we just want to know if you've seen him." Tracy told Lutz that she and Doug had broken up, and she hadn't seen him for the past couple of weeks. She gave Lutz the contact information for Doug's best friends, and these were Jerry Alexander and Jeff Bennett. She then mentioned that Doug's mother and a brother lived in Michigan, but that he didn't see them very often. But none of this was in Lutz's report, so either Tracy was lying about what she'd told him, or Lutz had been leaving out critical information from his report. What was in the report was that Tracy said she had last seen Doug on June 4th, but then later she would change her answer to June 5th. So it's never a good idea to change your story, and that's something Tracy did.
Yeah, well, I guess she figured that it would be better to say the last time I saw him was the day after he disappeared.
Maybe if she already hadn't said the 4th, but once you've set a date, you really should stick with it.
You should, unless you have a real strong reason.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it could happen that you could misspeak or something, but changing your story never looks good, especially if you're considered a suspect in something.
Right. So Sheriff Lutz is beginning to believe that foul play could be responsible for Doug's disappearance. After speaking with his friends and neighbors, he believed that Doug was not the type of guy to just leave without a word. Whenever he had left on a trip, Doug had always told someone where he was going and when he would be back, and he always made arrangements to have his birds taken care of.
Every single time.
Jeff and Doug had known each other for several years. Jeff told Lutz that he should contact Jerry Alexander, who's a mutual friend. Jerry might know where Doug went. Jeff had seen Doug's pickup truck at Jerry's house within the past week, but when he took a drive by Jerry's again just a day or two ago, the truck was gone. So maybe Doug had come by and picked up his truck.
That would make sense.
That would.
But
we don't know.
We don't know. But when asked about any trouble in Tracy and Doug's relationship, Jeff said that they had had a really big fight recently. Tracy had pulled a gun out and pointed it at herself and then at Doug. And this kind of follows behavior her father used to do with her mother. Then the fight had turned physical as well. Jeff told Lutz that the couple had fought many other times. In fact, he had stopped hanging out with Doug because he couldn't stand to be around Tracy. He said she was rude and angry, and she always interfered in Doug's business. She wouldn't leave him alone, Jeff said, and she nagged him about just about everything. So Lutz told Jeff he would get back in touch with him, but first he would call Doug's family to see if maybe Doug had gone off to Michigan. Maybe there'd been an emergency or something. Maybe he just wanted to get away from Tracy until things settled down a bit.
Yeah, so Doug's mother, Carol Benton, was out when Lutz called, but his brother was home. Doug's brother said that they hadn't heard from Doug in quite a while, and that wasn't like him. He always called, and he always stayed in touch with them. So Doug had not gone to Michigan, and he hadn't even called home during the past 2 weeks. So Lutz said he'd be calling back at some point. After getting this new information, he needed to speak with Tracy again. In his report, Lutz wrote, "I then called Tracy and asked her about the fight. Tracy avoided all questions about the fight, but said Doug called her and told her to stay away from him and his home."
So she's admitting to that.
Yeah.
And she would deny that she avoided questions about the fight. So Lutz then called the other friend, Jerry Alexander, and he asked if Doug's truck had been parked at his house, and Jerry said yes, it was. It had actually been dropped off in the middle of the night on the Sunday when Doug had last been seen, the 4th, and a note had been left with it. So Jerry read the note to Lutz, word for word. So the note read, "Jerry, I trust you to take care of my truck. Don't try to contact me. I'll contact you later." So to me, a big blazing red flag is don't try to contact me.
Right.
I can't say how many cases people have gone missing and ended up murdered where a note like that had been left.
Yeah. I've gone away to do some thinking.
Exactly.
Clear my head. Don't try to contact me.
Mm-hmm. So that was it. It seemed odd, even to Jerry. So Lutz made arrangements to go to Jerry's house and have a look. Jerry had known Doug for close to 10 years. He lived nearby in Lexington, Georgia. He used to work with Doug, and he'd gone to church with Jerry and his wife. So they were very close, Jerry said. Doug had actually gotten saved at his church, and that's when he'd kind of cleaned up his life. The more he thought about it, though, Jerry felt certain that Doug's truck had been dropped off at his house that Sunday night, June 4th, the same weekend he went missing, and he was sure because he hadn't heard anything. But then on Monday morning, June 5th, when he went outside, the truck was parked on the side of his yard. It had been parked at an odd angle, too, like it had been left in a hurry. When he saw the truck that morning, Jerry thought Doug was probably inside of the house sleeping. Maybe he'd come over in the middle of the night, didn't want to wake anyone up, just needed a place to crash, and he'd gone to sleep. So Jerry walked back into his house and looked all over, yelling for Doug, but he was nowhere to be found. He'd just left his truck there, and that's something he'd never done before in the 10 years. So there's another red flag.
Yes, and there's more. So Jerry had gone back out and looked inside the truck. He found the keys in the ignition. Very unusual for Doug. He always took his keys out. Jerry felt sure that this was something Doug just would not do. Much like his birds, Doug cared a great deal for his truck and normally took excellent care of it. And not only did Jerry find the keys, but he found the note that he'd read to Lutz. The note was attached on the side of the window with tape. Jerry pulled the note off the window and thought that it looked just like Doug's handwriting, because he always wrote in this scribbly-looking print. What worried Jerry the most about finding the truck and the note at his house was that he felt Doug had been battling some depression, and he worried that Doug, after dropping off the car, or the truck, had gone off and taken his own life.
Yeah, he had almost convinced himself that that's what had happened to Doug, and he was very sad. Jerry lived in a white house that was hidden behind overgrown trees and bushes. When Sheriff Lutz and another deputy came over on June 17th, Jerry met them outside in the driveway. Lutz asked Jerry to explain again how he had found the truck, but Jerry changed his story a little bit. He said that at first he didn't recognize the truck, so he searched through the glove box and found the registration with Doug's name on it, and he didn't mention the note until Lutz brought it up. Jerry said he did still have the note and it was inside of his house. So Lutz didn't see the truck, and Jerry said, well, I've moved it out back, but he couldn't remember exactly when he moved it. He said, listen, Doug had a lot of problems with depression. I don't think he left the property. He may have hung himself in that back building out there. So that was kind of weird, because if he thought that, why wouldn't he have checked that building?
Right. Yeah, so there was an abandoned barn out behind Jerry's house. Lutz and the deputy walked to the barn and looked around with flashlights. Doug wasn't in there. His truck was parked nearby, and they searched it. Nothing to the search. Lutz decided to call his lieutenant to see what he wanted to do. They had Doug's truck, the note, and several people telling them that they had not seen or heard from Doug in close to 2 weeks. So it's looking like Doug has gone somewhere and wasn't coming back.
Yeah, he reported to his lieutenant that he'd secured the truck, and then the lieutenant told him to have it towed to the sheriff's office. Lutz then explained to Jerry that they were going to have Doug's truck towed. It was standard practice in this type of situation. So Lutz made a call, and the tow truck was on the way to Jerry's. But this didn't go over well with Jerry, and I'm not sure why. But he became very angry and yelled that he wanted to see a warrant. Lutz explained to him as calmly as he could that a warrant wasn't needed. The truck was part of a missing persons investigation. So Jerry looked at the truck, then back at Lutz, kind of thinking this over. His wife came out then, out the back door, and came over to them. She seemed just as upset about the situation, and she told them that she had spoken to Tracy. She had called at about 10:30 that morning and asked if Jerry or his girlfriend had seen Doug because the sheriff was looking for him.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom? Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lutz asked Jerry's wife what else she could share with him about Tracy Fortson. According to her, Tracy had caused severe marital problems between her and Jerry. She clearly did not like Tracy, but she didn't have much more information to offer at that point. As they were talking, the tow truck showed up, and Jerry now seemed okay with letting it go. But he had one more thing to say to Lutz. "I know Doug, Sheriff, and Doug would never have left his house or let his birds die, so I know this is really serious." So that seemed to be the opinion of everyone who knew Doug, except for Tracy, who seemed to take it more lightly.
Yeah, she wasn't as concerned. I mean, to the officers, she appeared concerned, but not deeply concerned.
Well, yeah, and she seemed to kind of make some excuses for where he might be, like it wasn't that odd.
Right.
Now, another investigator for the Madison County Sheriff's Department was Buck Scoggins. Doesn't that sound like a Georgia investigator?
Uh-huh.
Call up Buck Scoggins and he'll figure things out. Now, he'd been involved on the periphery of the Doug Benton missing person case, as Lutz had been putting together information about the weekend when Doug went missing. Now, with Doug's truck sitting for 2 weeks at a friend's house, Doug was nowhere to be found. Scoggins was working the case when he came into the office on Sunday morning, June 18th, for his weekend shift. The plan was to dig deeper, calling up some of the people who they'd already talked to, and one of these people was the friend Jeff Bennett.
Yeah, so Scoggins called Jeff early Sunday morning after picking up the case where Lutz had left off. Jeff readily agreed to come back to the station. He said, after he had left the station the day before, he thought of something that might be important. He told Scoggins that Tracy had once taken Doug's pager, wallet, and cell phone after an argument. So this showed some of Tracy's character and behavior in a relationship with Doug. Not groundbreaking information, but Jeff had more. He explained he had known Doug for 16 years. They met as welders in Barrow County, Jeff explained, while both were working for a company called Base Manufacturing. He said that he and Doug were close and saw each other all of the time until he became involved with Tracy. And he told Scoggins, "Tracy is a dominating person and is basically a possessive tomboy type of person. She demanded that Doug show her constant attention. She's manipulative and has violent tendencies. She demanded to know all of his affairs, and she consumed all of his time. She always wanted to know who he was with and where he was."
And it's not like she was subtle about that. She was very outspoken.
No, she doesn't have to be subtle. She's a tough chick.
Yeah. Well, according to Jeff, Doug had told him many times that Tracy would get violent with him. When they weren't getting along, she'd threaten to shoot herself or she'd take things from his house. Scoggins was experienced enough to take what Doug's friend was saying with a grain of salt. You know, maybe he just didn't like her. But if he was correct, the relationship between Doug and Tracy was a bit more volatile than everyday boyfriend-girlfriend arguments. I would hope so.
For certain.
Yeah, there could be more to it. So Jeff went on to say that Tracy had explained to him that she had beaten up both of her ex-husbands and that one of them she'd hit in the head with a pipe. So she's pretty fucking scary, really.
She is. She's violent.
She is, and I think if she was a man, it would have been more alarming. Because you don't expect a woman to be that way, but there are women who are. So afterwards, she'd lied to the police, saying a burglar had hit her ex-husband. She admitted to that. And she also told Doug that she once set her trailer home on fire, trying to burn it with the ex-husband inside. But she said the fire went out. So remember that, because that information's going to become more significant later on in the investigation.
Okay.
We're going to see some similar stuff.
Now, Tracy had also threatened to shoot herself once. She held a gun to her head in order to get Doug to stay with her.
Yeah, and maybe more than once, because we don't have Doug around to tell us anything.
Yeah. Then whenever they had a big argument, she would go home, and then once home she'd call him constantly until he would let her return. So if what Jeff said was true, Doug and Tracy's relationship was dangerous. Boy, it sure was.
Yeah, it was just something like a powder keg just waiting to explode, really. Tracy had also done some work for Doug after she left the sheriff's department. She worked on the computer, doing filing and paying bills, and Doug had told Jeff that once they got into an argument and she went into his house and started deleting documents and records off of the computer. So not only is that immature, that's spiteful, and it shows a lack of control on her part. When Doug realized what she was doing, Jeff said, he grabbed Tracy and pulled her away, but then Tracy ran outside, and she tried to kick over one of his Harleys. She turned around when he stopped her, and she punched him. So Doug had grabbed Tracy by her throat and held her against the garage wall. And that day he had warned her, "Don't you ever try to hit me again." Then he let her go. As Tracy left, walking towards her truck, she had yelled back at him, "I will kill your ass." She then reached inside, likely to get her gun. But Doug walked over quickly, picked up his rifle, and pointed it at her. "I will shoot you if you get out of that truck with your pistol," he told her. So Tracy had started her truck and raced out of the driveway then. But you know, all of this just portrays a dangerous relationship which could have ended in violence.
Well, I guess.
This is either way, on either side.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And this is chilling stuff.
It really is scary. Jeff had last seen Doug on May 23rd, he said, when they lifted weights together. He had planned to meet him again on May 25th, but then he decided not to because he didn't like being around Tracy.
Yeah, so neither Jeff nor his wife liked hanging out with her.
No, it seems like most of Doug's friends were anti-Tracy.
And it was getting to be a difficulty. Nobody wanted to hang out with Doug anymore.
Yeah, so Doug had finally broken up with her,
yeah.
And then he disappeared.
So after Jeff left the station, Scoggins decided that there was much more instability and anger in Doug and Tracy's relationship than what they had originally believed. Tracy and Doug could both become angry and turn to violence. Doug had admitted to Jeff that he once grabbed his girlfriend by the throat and pointed a gun in her face. Dangerous behavior in a romantic relationship could lead to bad outcomes, as Scoggins knew well. So he decided he needed to get Tracy to come in for a more formal interview. She could be involved in his disappearance, or he could have hurt himself due to depression. Scoggins called Tracy, and she agreed to come to the station that evening.
So Tracy returned to the sheriff's office at 6 p.m. on June 18th. This was a voluntary interview. Tracy told Scoggins that she had last seen Doug on June 5th. Between 6 and 8 p.m., she'd gone to see him. She'd been trying to make up, but Doug wanted nothing to do with that. She said that Doug was jealous and bitter, and that she left his house by 10:30 and then received a voicemail from him later. And in the voicemail, he told her, "Do not come over or call me anymore. The relationship is over." So it sounded pretty final.
It sure did.
Then as the search for Doug continued into Monday, June 19th, Tracy was still waiting to hear from the Department of Labor about the next hearing for her civil suit. But another hearing would never happen. As Doug's location became the focus of the investigative team, more consideration was given to that strange note that Doug had supposedly left on his truck in his friend Jerry's driveway. After a professional examination of Doug's handwriting, several investigators believed that there was no way Doug could have written that note. Madison County Sheriff Clayton Lowe actually came out publicly saying that someone else had written it.
Farmer Rob Poston and his wife were out on their 1,500 acres of cattle land that Rob oversaw. This was on a Sunday afternoon. Rob caught sight of an oblong coffin-shaped metal container. So he pulled over his ATV and went to check out what it was. Seeing the object was odd, but there was something much more concerning, and that was the intense and rancid smell of death.
So Rob's job on the farm he supervised had many responsibilities. With a large herd of beef cattle, he was always traveling the area, looking out for predators or any problems with the cattle. Living on the farm with his wife and daughter, Rob knew these 1,500 acres very well. "We kind of have a game preserve, too," he said, "where people do a lot of hunting and whatnot on the property. Some friends of the owner and others were familiar with this land, and that included Tracy Fortson, who had hunted there more than once." Rob and his wife were out on an ATV, four-wheeling over the back part of the farm, because his daughter had been riding an ATV the day before, and she got a flat. so Rob had gone out to this remote section of the farm to fix the tire. This was part of the property that he rarely went to. It was after turkey season and it was before deer season, so they normally didn't go back there during this time of year. After fixing the flat, Rob went about a quarter mile over a low hill, and then he saw the metal object. It was sticking out just above the soil line a few inches, and there was just this decaying smell all around it.
And as he approached the object, Rob identified it as a cattle trough. Now, the smell of death and decomposition was pretty overwhelming, and it just didn't make sense for a cattle trough to be out in the middle of nowhere, poorly hidden and partly buried. Rob took a closer look and saw that the trough was full of something. His first thought was that someone had filled the trough with garbage, drove it out there, and left it. This trough, Rob realized, was brand new, and it was painted on the outside to look like camouflage. He tried to move it, but it was way too heavy.
Yeah, so he took some pictures of it and then went back to get his tractor. An hour later, he hoisted the trough out of the ground with the tractor. It had been buried down just several inches, and one end was a little deeper into the ground than the other. And it looked like it was filled with freshly dried concrete. On the outside, there was new paint in spotted greens, blacks, and browns in a clear attempt to make it camouflaged. And it was also covered on the top with fresh soil. Not dirt from the farm, but it looked like the kind you would buy. Rob actually thought it was peat moss, which you use on a lawn or a garden and you buy in a store by the bag. So once they got the trough moved on the top of the ground, Rob and his wife tried to flip it over, but it was just way too heavy. Rob had a feeling that something was really wrong here. He was just starting to get a really bad feeling. So he decided to call the sheriff. The Oglethorpe County Sheriff, Mike Smith, drove over to the farm along with an investigator from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. This was Special Agent Ben Williams. Using the tractor, Rob Poston and Mike Smith managed to flip the trough on its side. The sheriff had a small chisel and screwdriver, and before he began to break the concrete, he made notes about the trough. It was covered with some kind of black material, and it looked like it was encased with cement, and there was a very foul odor coming from it. So Smith decided to see if Rob, using the forks on the front of his tractor, could pick it up off the ground and drop it, and then maybe it would crack open the concrete. But that didn't work. With the horrid smell, the coffin-like size of the trough, and a thick black liquid draining from it, they all began to realize that there probably wasn't an animal in that concrete.
They probably could have realized that sooner.
And they may have.
Yeah,
they may
but they're not just getting more confirmation.
Exactly. So Smith called EMS and the coroner just in case it was a body. Although they were towards the back of the farm, this was an area that was easily accessible from the road. It could be accessed through one dirt road connecting to the main road. So a vehicle could turn off the main road and drive down the dirt road to where the trough was found, no problem.
And there are actually two gates to get through before entering the property at this part of the farm. Rob rode over to both while the sheriff and agent were with the trough, and he saw that one of the gates had been busted open. Well, then the coroner and EMS arrived. Smith believed that whatever they were about to uncover inside the trough and concrete could require the services of the medical examiner. Smith had experience with the odor coming from the trough. It smelled like a dead human body. So he used his chisel and screwdriver to make a crack in the concrete, and then he stepped back as a disgusting liquid drizzled out.
It had to be horrible.
Gets worse, because then he saw a human arm.
Mm.
Looking at the arm, Smith had a good idea of who the dead man encased in the concrete was. He knew that arm because he had seen it before. There was a familiar tattoo of a single rose that was visible on the arm. And Smith knew Doug Benton because he had spent time at the Oglethorpe Sheriff's Office visiting his former girlfriend, Tracy Fortson. He remembered seeing a missing persons report for Doug Benton recently. Investigators contacted the office to confirm that the man buried in the concrete was very likely Doug Benton. It looked like someone had murdered him, put his body in a horse trough, and then covered the corpse with fresh concrete.
Yeah, so of course his identity would need to be confirmed. They weren't going to just go by that. But the investigators felt confident that they had found Doug Benton. Doug's mother and brother were on their way to town, and by then they needed to get Doug's body out of the trough and make a positive ID. Until then, they worked under the assumption that Doug had been murdered. Before driving back to the sheriff's department, Sheriff Smith and Agent Williams stopped at Jerry Alexander's house. Jerry had just gotten home from work as they pulled into his driveway, and they asked Jerry if he would follow them down to the sheriff's office so they could talk. Once they got there, Smith and the other investigators sat with Jerry in a private room, and Smith told Jerry that Doug was found dead. But it wasn't a suicide, it was a homicide. After Jerry had some time to collect himself, he began talking about Tracy. He described Doug and Tracy's relationship in relation to how Doug's body had been found. Jerry later said that he hadn't planned on pointing his finger at Tracy as a suspect, but she was the first thing that came to his mind. He had genuinely believed that Doug had gone out into the woods and killed himself. He had even contacted some friends, including a local sheriff he knew, and planned to search the woods for Doug's body. One of the men Jerry spoke with had called Tracy, but to this guy, Tracy didn't seem to care. She didn't express an urgent need to go out looking for Doug, and she never showed up to help either, even though she had said that she would. Now, as we know, 8 out of 10 people murdered are killed by someone who they knew, so the odds were that Doug had known his killer. Jerry called Doug and Tracy's arguments huge spectacles. He said Doug had told him about a time when Tracy had pointed a gun at herself and then pointed it at Doug. "I told Doug on many occasions," Jerry said through his tears, "that he needed to leave Tracy and get away from her." Now, he hadn't been the only one to give Doug that advice either. So had Doug finally followed that advice, breaking up with her, and ended up getting killed for it?
Well,
it was certainly possible.
Looking that way.
Yeah.
So then the sheriff's office had additional information. The magnetic sign on Doug's truck, which advertised his business name and telephone number, had been taken off the doors. Also, the driver's seat in Doug's truck had been pushed back farther than its normal position for Doug to drive. Jerry told the sheriff that they needed to talk to a guy Tracy had previously lived with. Jerry knew him, and he knew that Tracy had pulled a gun on him when she used to live with him. So later that evening, Special Agent Williams contacted Jeff Bennett and explained that his friend Doug was dead and it wasn't a suicide. Jeff said nothing for a long pause, and then he said, "Tracy probably has something to do with it."
So both of Doug's good friends, their minds went to Tracy right away. And there's nothing scientific about that, but it's just a real red flag to me.
Oh, absolutely.
So the following morning was Tuesday, June 20th, and a team from multiple police agencies got a warrant to go search Doug's house. There was this second crime scene somewhere because Doug obviously was not murdered on the cattle ranch where they found his body. The medical examiner's office reported that Doug had been shot and stabbed. The autopsy took a long time due to Doug's body being encased in concrete. It must have been a horrible, horrible scene.
I can only imagine. Although at the same time, you have to admire the killer's ingenuity for using the concrete.
I guess, but it just seems really stupid to me because it was sticking out of the ground. And if they did find it, it was obviously done on purpose.
Well, sure.
So it wasn't the smartest way to kill someone that I've ever heard of.
No, but you're hoping that the concrete will eliminate or obscure clues.
Well, apparently concrete doesn't do anything about odors.
Apparently not.
So the MCSD investigator, Scoggins, was part of the team going to Doug's house. Scoggins had gone into Doug's house on June 17th, the day that Doug had been reported missing by his neighbor, Larry Bridges. And when Scoggins went in that first time, there were several unusual things. Scoggins said that on the 17th, he smelled nothing unusual when entering Doug's house. Things actually looked pretty normal, but there was a strange piece of equipment that stood out to him. A large blower was inside the house. So it's one of those big industrial fans that they put to dry out places. They use it after floods or when they clean carpeting. You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
So why was that in his house? Scoggins thought maybe there'd been some sort of bad smell that Doug had been trying to get rid of, but he didn't smell anything. So it was really odd for a blower to be running in the house of a man who hadn't even been home in 2 weeks. It's not like anyone was working on the house or anything. There was no explanation for this.
Yeah, no, that's distinctly unusual.
Absolutely. But then when they walked into the house on June 20th, 3 days later, it was a very different experience. There was a distinct smell to Doug's house. By this time, the team knew that Doug had been murdered, and they were there to see if the murder had happened inside of his house. With the discovery of his body, the blower had a new significance. Now, Doug lived in a modified mobile home, and when they were out there on June 17th, Scoggins had noticed a water hose lying on the ground, trickling a small stream of water out of the nozzle. Now, the hose was normally there to provide water for his birds, but now they thought maybe it had been used to mix concrete.
Maybe.
So when they were doing their search on June 20th, they stood on Doug's wooden deck and just kind of took an overview look. They had a good view of the yard, and looking around the yard from the deck, they noticed impressions near a few bushes on the side of the deck. Also, now the water hose, which had been left on 3 days before, had been shut off by someone. It looked like a vehicle had been on the grass, and looking down from the deck, there were shallow tire impressions in the grass. Some bushes had also been damaged where the vehicle had likely backed up to that deck. So why would a vehicle back up to Doug's deck after he was dead? To move a body, perhaps?
Well, perhaps.
Scoggins never reported seeing the indentation or broken branches when he and Doug's neighbor were out there just days earlier. Investigators walked into Doug's home, and this included GBI Special Agent and Crime Scene Specialist Terry Cooper. Several things seemed out of place right away to them, and the biggest thing was the smell of an accelerant or fuel. As soon as they entered the house, just hit them like a brick wall. It was thick in the air. Scoggins had not recognized the smell in the home 3 days earlier, which meant someone had to have come into the house during that 3 days in between. So what they needed to do was find the source of that smell. And as they entered the living room, an agent immediately noticed a discoloration on the couch. It was a pink in color couch, and one area on the cushion looked more worn than anywhere else. It looked like someone had scrubbed it.
Yeah, this discoloration was on a part of the fabric where someone had apparently rubbed and tried to clean the couch, which wore down the fabric. Near the armrest and back of it on the carpet, there was a candle, and it had burned down to a small nub. There was a small burn mark on the arm of the couch, too. Near the right side of the couch lay another burned-down candle. An investigator took photos and cut the candle from the carpet to take as evidence. He also cut open a section of the couch cushion, and this revealed a large reddish-brown stain that would test positive for the presence of blood. So after examining the whole couch, investigators found several areas that had been saturated with blood, mostly on one end. So to get underneath the couch and see the carpet directly beneath, the couch needed to be moved. And beneath the carpet, there was more reddish-brown stains. So there had been lots of blood spilled, and it was obvious that the blood had flowed down from the couch by the armrest and to the right side. A stream of blood had run down in between the cushion and the armrest, through the padding of the couch and onto the carpet, through the carpet fibers and into the padding. So certainly a minor household injury wouldn't bleed like that.
No.
And a bloody nose wouldn't do that.
No, this had to be a very severe injury. Likely a death, really, let's be honest.
Yeah. So the reasoning or the thinking is that Doug had been murdered as he was lying on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
And it appeared that Doug had been leaning his head on the armrest when he sustained a massive head injury. We know that the head bleeds profusely. Also, the blood had dried, so it had been days since the injury had happened.
Absolutely. So, because Doug was a big, strong guy, the thought was that someone had snuck up on him while he was sleeping and shot him in the top of his head. After they pulled back the carpet, the kerosene smell was much more intense. It started underneath where the couch was, and it spread across the floor toward the wood-burning heater. So Doug's killer had apparently murdered him on the couch where he was probably sleeping, and then tried to clean up. Then, not being able to clean up such a massive amount of blood, the killer likely poured kerosene over the couch and the carpet, leaving a trail to the wood-burning heater. A candle was placed on the carpet near the couch and lit in hopes that the candle would burn down and ignite the kerosene and burn the house to the ground, basically. But the candle had burned out, leaving behind the forensic evidence that they were now collecting.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So much accelerant had been poured over the inside of Doug's home, which was basically a double-wide trailer, that the investigators' latex gloves were wet with it after cutting and lifting the saturated carpet off of the floor. Stains on a doorknob and a cabinet looked like someone may have left fingerprints, but when tested, they were smooth, meaning that whoever had touched these surfaces had worn gloves.
So Doug's mom and brother arrived in town, and they were told the news that Doug was dead. Tracy had been staying at her mother's house with her daughter, Elise. She received a call from her cousin, telling her what was happening with the investigation. She told Tracy where his body had been found, and that she was the prime suspect. Now, Tracy had a relative who worked for a lawyer out of Athens, Georgia. This guy's name was Tom Camp, and he was an experienced criminal defense attorney. So Tracy's family supported her, and they hired Camp to represent her.
So forensic investigators analyzed the inside of Doug's truck. They photographed everything before touching it. And one of the first things they noticed was a piece of tape that had been used to attach the note that had been left on the driver's side window of his truck. So they photographed that. But this wasn't common scotch tape like you use to wrap Christmas presents. It was a very specific type of tape. This was fingerprint lifting tape. So whoever had attached that note to Doug's truck had the same tape an investigator would use to lift fingerprints from objects. So if Doug had attached the note, why would he use fingerprint tape? The fingerprint tape was tested for prints, but there were only smooth impressions. So if he had done that, why would he wear gloves to put a note on his own truck? It wouldn't make any sense for Doug to wear gloves. So someone who had put that note on the truck had been wearing gloves. That same week on June 20th, Tracy's attorney Tom Camp called her, and he told her there was a warrant out for her arrest. He had arranged for her to meet him at the sheriff's office to turn herself in. So they moved pretty quickly on this.
They did. So investigators photographed the spray-painted galvanized watering trough, and then they cut out the bottom so they could remove Doug's body. Now, there were several items in the concrete that could be important to the investigation. One of these items was a maroon in color plastic shower curtain, along with a clear shower curtain with blue, red, and yellow designs of seashells and starfish. Also, there was a beige-colored bedsheet with colored floral prints. Now, investigators couldn't determine the original color of the bedsheet because it had been soaked with body fluids that had drained from Doug's body. There was also a cord tied around Doug's waist, two thin ropes tied around his feet, and a piece of red and white plastic covering both.
So also on Tuesday, June 20th, medical examiner Dr. Jeffrey Smith began Doug's autopsy. His body had been removed from the concrete and the watering trough, put on a gurney, and taken into the autopsy area at the GBI Division of Forensic Sciences in Decatur. Dr. Smith described Doug's body as moderately decomposed with skin slippage, especially on his hands, which were basically degloved.
Ew.
Yeah. So this is a horrible image. There was also noted bloating of the body cavities, greening, and an intense odor of putrefaction. So Smith wrote that in his report. Partially mummified because of the concrete, Smith reported Doug's underlying soft tissues to be in very good shape. So his height was listed as 69 inches or 5 feet 9. but the state of his body upon arrival for the autopsy had left him weighing just 113 pounds. Doug had been twice that weight at least. Being encased in the concrete had taken out most of the liquid from his body, leaving behind just bones and mostly decomposed tissue. All of his organs had dried up, causing the significant reduction in his weight, and Dr. Smith would note that Doug's body was wrapped in a shower curtain, a sheet, and a second shower curtain, the same items that investigators had noted and taken photos of prior to the autopsy.
The right side of Doug's underwear, over his right buttock, was covered with slashes from what was likely the blade of a knife. The location of the injuries told investigators that they were probably correct in speculating Doug had been on his couch sleeping on his side, wearing only his underpants, when his killer snuck up and murdered him. There were no defensive wounds, so Doug had trusted his killer and knew them. If it were a surprise attack, Doug's killer could have been weaker and smaller, worried that Doug could overpower him or her. The knife wounds on Doug's buttocks and on the midsection of his torso were examined to determine if they could have been made when the concrete was chipped away with a screwdriver, either back at the cattle ranch or when the trough was hoisted off the ground with pointed pitchfork-like levers on Rob Poston's tractor. But the medical examiner determined that the marks were made from a stabbing with a sharp object, like a knife. Now, this would come up in Tracy's trial when her attorney argued that these slashes could have come from the efforts to remove him and lift the trough. The medical examiner, however, said that the wounds were inflicted right around the time of death, not days afterwards. And anyway, even if that was incorrect, it wouldn't help in proving Tracy's innocence. Doug had also been shot in his head.
Exactly.
The ME found one gunshot to the head and 10 stab wounds on Doug's body.
Yeah, so you can argue all you want about the stab wounds. He was still shot to death in his head.
That's right.
So the gunshot wound to the top of Doug's head showed a blackening of the edges around it, but there was no stippling. The surrounding skin was too decomposed to show stippling, but there really was no question about Doug being shot at very close range, possibly with the barrel of the gun held directly against the top of his skull. After studying the entrance wound, Smith went into Doug's skull with a pair of tweezers and searched for a bullet or a fragment. The brain had pretty much liquefied, Dr. Smith noted, so the bullet was floating in what remained.
Another image to forget.
I know. These people that do this work, I have to give them credit. I don't think I could stomach it. But in his report, Dr. Smith called the fragment a greatly deformed small caliber bullet. In his final analysis, Dr. Smith determined that Doug had died of consequences of a contact range penetrating gunshot of the head and multiple stab wounds. The cause of death was the combined effects of multiple stab wounds and gunshot of the head, and the manner of death was homicide.
On Tuesday, June 20th, investigator Mike Smith got a tip about a man who had painted an SUV with a similar camo design as to what had been painted on the watering trough that Doug's body had been found in. This man told investigators that he owned a Blazer, which he painted in camouflage. And he also added that he had a friend who once dated Tracy Fortson.
Now that's significant to me because it means she may have seen this.
Sure. Now this friend had broken up with Tracy in 1999. And this friend owned some property that was adjacent to the farm where Doug's body had been found. So the police went to the house where he kept his Blazer and took photos of it. The design was similar but still different from the colors on the watering trough.
Well, just the fact that she had a boyfriend right near that property, that she'd hunted on the property, that she'd seen a similar camouflage pattern.
Yeah.
It's all just
good
circumstantial stuff, yeah. Then on June 21st, the search warrant came in for Tracy's home. A new investigator named Cross took the sheriff department's video camera there, and his job was to videotape the search process. And this was very fortunate because a lot of evidence was found that day. And one of the first things they noticed was Tracy's mailbox. It was painted in camouflage, similar to the trough. Inside of the house, investigators found an open box of small rubber gloves, .22 ammo in Tracy's bedroom, a .22 caliber Stevens model 15-bolt action rifle in the second bedroom, a .22 caliber Stinger ammo in the kitchen, 3 spray paint cans, black, green, and khaki color, in the garage, 1 spent .22 caliber round in the yard beside the carport, 2 towels from the bathroom with stains consistent with blood, 2 .22 caliber bullets from the back bedroom dresser, and 2 rolls of white medical tape, which was very similar to the tape that had been used to tape the sheet and curtains around Doug's body.
So why would you keep that lying around your house?
Well, that's what I was trying to say, is this wasn't the smartest thing.
You put all the stuff in a box and then you get rid of it.
You would think, especially someone who's a sheriff's deputy.
Yeah.
But if you want to look at it from Tracy's side, this was all done to set her up. Because why would she do that? She was too smart. So someone must have done that to frame her, is what she said.
Of course, it's evidence of conspiracy.
Well, it's what she said. So Investigator Cross videotaped the inside of the bathroom before he entered, and what he noticed right away with that bathroom was the smell. It was that synthetic smell of brand new plastic shower curtain. We've all smelled that when you put it up in your bathroom.
Oh, sure.
And all of the creases were still in it, like it had just been unwrapped. They also found Tracy's duty belt, which is a black leather, bulky belt that police wear around their waist to hold their weapon, their handcuffs, and their flashlight. But Tracy, unlike most other deputies, had an extra leather pouch on her belt where she always kept a knife. But now the knife was missing from the belt. So investigators went back to the farm where the trough was found to look for more evidence. They noticed a nearby tree with marks on the bark. And some of the marks were about waist high, but others were just a little bit lower. The markings showed that something had been tied to the tree with some pressure exerted. It appeared to investigators on the scene that someone had tied a rope or a cable to the tree and pulled it tight enough to leave an indentation in the bark around the circumference of the tree. So they theorized that Doug's killer tied one end of a rope or cable to the trough, positioned it on the back of their truck, and then the other end to the tree, and then they drove forward, using the tree to pull the trough off the bed of the truck so it would plop onto the ground.
Pretty clever.
Pretty clever, and lots of evidence.
Yeah, well, and things just got worse for Tracy. Her truck was brought into Madison County for forensic processing, and upon visual inspection, cement splatters were seen in the bed of the truck. So it looked as if someone had been mixing concrete in the back of the truck and had splashed some of it. Also in the bed of her truck were several bags of potting soil. The rear driver's side taillight was broken, and there were several cans of spray paint in camo colors found inside the cab. Reports referred to what they found in and on Tracy's truck as significant items of evidence.
Sure.
Yeah. Scratches of paint consistent with metal against metal were also identified in the bed of the truck. Measurements of her bumper height also matched measurements of the gouges in the tree.
Well, investigators concluded that the note was written in Tracy's handwriting, which she had tried to disguise, and that the tape used to hold it was the same as what had been given to Tracy when she was a deputy. Then they also found a receipt for a shower curtain that was bought on June 4th and spray cans that matched the camouflage paint on the trough. They were also able to locate the guy who sold Tracy the trough and the cement. Now he had actually had a conversation with her. He knew her. And one thing she had asked him, there was like a center bar across the top of the trough. And she asked him if that could be removed. And he was able to remove it quite easily. So she would confess to buying these items. But then she said that she had purchased them to make a dog pen and that they were stolen from her. So she told the police about a drug dealer who had previously threatened Doug's life. And she suggested that her items were used in a plot to frame her for Doug's murder. According to Tracy, the plot could have come from either the drug dealer or from the sheriff's office. She referenced her civil suit against the sheriff's department as a motive for her being framed for Doug's murder, which is a big stretch, that you're going to murder an innocent person to stop a civil suit.
Right.
It's a stretch.
Very big.
Mm-hmm.
So Tracy was held in protective custody when she was in jail. Solitary confinement was necessary because Tracy had been a deputy, and there was a chance that she could be recognized by someone in the general population. While she's in jail, Tracy dropped her sexual harassment suit, claiming that she was being framed because of the suit. And by dropping it, she might be released and the charges dropped. Right.
That's just ludicrous.
Wistful thinking.
Yeah.
Didn't happen either.
No. Well, if Tracy was right about being framed, it meant that there would have been four groups of investigators. That would be the state crime lab, the state medical examiner, numerous officers and deputies, along with the DA and the assistant DA, involved in this cover-up at some level. Tracy was claiming that they had put together all of that evidence against her because of her sexual harassment claim. And this was far-fetched, likely even impossible once you consider the circumstances that would all have to line up and all of the coincidences that would have to happen. And that still left the motive for Doug's murder. Seems totally crazy to me to believe that law enforcement would get together and plot to kill Doug just to get Tracy arrested to stop the harassment suit.
There's too many implausible steps there.
Absolutely.
So Tracy went on trial in July 2001. She pleaded not guilty. But the jury convicted her on one count of malice murder, one count of felony murder, two counts of aggravated assault, and one count of attempted arson. So she was given a life sentence for the murder, and then 20 years for the aggravated assault, and 10 years for the attempted arson. So that's a long time.
That's what you deserve if you did this thing.
She appealed her conviction that same year, but her petition was denied.
But then Tracy was able to get her conviction overturned in October of 2003, and the court ordered a retrial. In her 2004 retrial, Tracy was again convicted and sent back to prison for life. She again tried to get her conviction overturned in 2017, but she was not successful. Then in 2020, Tracy's mother and a friend of hers appeared on the TV show Reasonable Doubt to have them look at Tracy's case and possibly help to get her conviction reversed. This is my favorite crime show, at least right now. Really good show. So Chris Anderson and Fatima Silva, a retired homicide detective and an attorney, they looked into Tracy's case, and they found that a neighbor who had claimed to have heard a gunshot on June 4th in the vicinity of Doug's house hadn't mentioned hearing that shot until months after Doug's murder. They also questioned if she could have heard a .22 shot from her house if it was shot inside of Doug's house. But other than that, there really wasn't much that would help Tracy. People had said that a woman wouldn't be able to get him in that trough and take him out there. But they had a woman her size try it. And I'd say that Tracy was probably stronger than most women her size. But it was certainly possible, because by the time he was in the truck, if you mix the concrete while the trough and the body are in the truck, then the trough gets really heavy. But she didn't have to pick up the trough or move it if she did that thing with the tree and a cord. So it was definitely possible for her to do that physically.
Yeah, but there wasn't really anything that's going to help Tracy.
No, they became very convinced that she was guilty as well. Her theory that she was framed just wasn't credible at all. And when Chris and Fatima learned about Tracy's purchases of the trough, the cement, the spray paint, and the shower curtain, they said that's just overwhelming evidence.
It certainly is.
They couldn't help. So, of course, I feel sad for her mother and anyone who cares about her. She also has a daughter. But she just seems guilty as hell.
I'd have to say so.
Yeah.
So she is currently serving out her life sentence in the Lee Arundale State Prison in Rowell, Georgia.
That's right. So TCB's music is written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you have comments, a case suggestion, or a beer you'd like to recommend to us, please send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. You can go to our website to write a comment also, or leave us a voicemail. I'll also leave a direct link in our show notes for you to do that. If you're interested in getting your future TCB episodes commercial-free and getting access to our extra members-only episode that we put out each and every month, plus getting a gift, you might want to consider signing up as a tiegrabber at tiegrabber.com. Also, if you do enjoy our show, we would very much appreciate it if you'd leave us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen to us.
So I got some feedback for you, Jill.
Great. So let's listen first to a voicemail from Minty. And Minty has called in at least once before.
She has. She seems to like us.
Hi, Jill and Dick. I just wanted to say this is Araminta Verwise Minty from Grayling, Michigan. And just wanted to say, I know I've suggested the baby Kate, I know I've suggested Dorothy Kilgallen, but I really wanted to know if you guys have done the one on the astronaut lady that went to kill the, she was seeing another astronaut. I'm not sure of what it is, but she had a breakup and she went and drove overnight to take on her rival. I would really love to hear you guys do that story. Anyways, I just wanted to say I've grown interested in beer for the first time in my life, and I love hearing the beer review. And I don't know, I just think you guys are great and funny and just wonderful. And I can't get enough, so I've been binging on all the old episodes. So anyways, thanks so much for everything, and hopefully maybe we can get that other story done of the astronaut lady. I'm sorry, I can't remember her name, but I remember the story, so maybe we can do that. All right, guys, thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks, Minty. I appreciate it very much. You're too kind.
Yeah, but it's all true that she says.
Of course. So this is a story that's fascinated me for years. The story of Lisa Nowick, an astronaut who drove from Houston to Orlando to confront her former boyfriend's new girlfriend. And I think the most famous thing about this in the press that you hear about over and over is how she wore a diaper so she wouldn't have to stop.
Yeah, no, that's not confirmed, so it might be kind of apocryphal.
Well, maybe, but astronauts do wear those.
Yes, they do.
So I find it fascinating. We've discussed it. It didn't actually have a murder, but she did attack this woman and intended to murder her. And I would be really interested in finding out more and covering it. So I think we should go ahead and do it.
I'll put that down.
Okay, let's do it sooner than later.
Okay.
So thanks a lot, Minty. That was a great suggestion. And now I'm going to have Dickie read an email from Susan.
Susan has a case suggestion. And she says, my daughter and I enjoy your podcast. I live in Boulder, Colorado, and have a case suggestion for you. The murder of Susanna Chase. A summary of the case from CBS News. Chase of Stamford, Connecticut, had left a pizzeria after getting into an argument with her boyfriend. She was attacked a block from her home in Boulder on December 21, 1997, and then dumped in an alley. She died in the hospital the day after the attack, which was the same day she was supposed to fly home to Connecticut for Christmas. And the case went unsolved for 10 years, until a DNA sample related to a separate Wyoming kidnapping linked a man named Olmos Alcalde to Chase's slaying.
So this is a stranger?
Stranger. Yep.
Okay. Well, that's super sad. She was supposed to go home for Christmas and was murdered and dumped like a piece of trash. So that's a horrible story.
Yeah. And they had no good leads or clues until this DNA popped up.
Right.
She says, I remember the case very well. It was really scary. Went unsolved for such a long time. It was a huge relief when they caught her killer and sentenced him to life in prison. Susanna sounded like a wonderful young woman, and it was a huge loss to the Boulder community and the University of Colorado community. I felt unsafe for quite some time after the attack, as it happened in downtown Boulder, an area that many of us felt safe in. I think it would be great to remember Susanna.
I do too, and I have to tell you, I love Boulder. I think we would have moved there if it was warmer. It's just too damn cold. But what a great downtown area in Boulder, right?
Yeah, no, we went up for Anissa's wedding. It was just a great weekend.
Wonderful place, very vegan friendly, nice beer, just a great place to hang out.
What more could you want?
I can't think of much more you'd want. So I think it would probably necessitate a trip for us in order to research this, which I'm willing to make that sacrifice.
Okay. We'll do that.
Okay.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you, Susan.
And then one more email from Jacqueline, and she has a case suggestion.
Okay, so Jacqueline writes, I have a case suggestion. With all the current focus on Blue Point, Long Island, because of Gabrielle Petito, everyone seems to have forgotten the 1990 crime at Christmas time in the same town, where the celebrated doctor, Robert Reza, involved in an affair with the organist at his family's New Life Community Church, sneaked back from a business trip to D.C., killed his wife, and then returned to D.C. Check out his name in the New York Times archives. So I did that, because anything with a doctor. And something about church, too. Doctors and churches.
Yeah, you got it.
Something about that really piques my interest. So I did look up the archives in the New York Times. I found 5 or 6 articles. Definitely want to do this case as well. So I think we have 3 case suggestions here, which are going to go right to the top of our list because they're all fascinating.
They are. Reza, he was not just a doctor. He was a big-time doctor.
Mm-hmm.
He was pretty famous.
Yeah.
Publishing, did a lot.
Yes. And his motive was what?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I kind of assumed it was so he could be with this woman he was having the affair with.
Yeah. But usually that doesn't work out.
No, it doesn't. But he did get caught. He was convicted in 1992 for the killing of his wife. And he actually died in prison in 2012.
Wow. So he was only in his early 60s or mid-60s when he died in prison.
Right.
Huh. So yeah, fascinating case. Thank you, Jacqueline.
We got some good stuff to look at.
We really do. I really appreciate feedback, so keep it coming. It's my favorite thing about the show. I've said it before, but it's true. It's absolutely true. So thanks for talking with me today, Dickie. I appreciate it very much. I have to say this beer is absolutely delicious. I love it.
Isn't it good?
It's a perfect sipping beer.
Yeah, you have a little snifter, you know, maybe a 8-ounce serving.
Yeah, you don't need a lot.
No.
It's very calming, very tasty, and not too filling either.
No, good beer.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you. Although I'm pretty lucky. I can always trust you to bring me some good beers.
Well, I know your likes.
Yes, you do. Okay, thank you, everyone. We'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
We'll save some seats for you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.